Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thank you for downloading, subscribing, and rating. Coming up on this week's program, we'll be speaking to Dr. Suzanne O'Sullivan about the challenges of overdiagnosis. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience. We get to all of those comments at the end of the pod. First, though, it's time to look back at some of the more interesting stories from the world of science this week. And we're joined by Dr. Shelley Brady from DCU and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. Our first story, Shelley, has to do with fertility.
Yeah, so when Dolly the sheep was cloned back in 1996, it marked the dawn of a new age in genetics, and there was a lot of scientific celebration, but also a lot of fear, moral panic, and a fair amount of philosophical anxiety. And I actually remember studying in UCD a long time ago in 1999, and it was one of my very first assignments was on the ethical implications of Dolly the cloned sheep. Now, she didn't lead to cloned humans, but she did transform biology and stem cell research. And what was once considered scandalous has become foundational science. And now that legacy is continuing, and it builds on the same principles used to clone Dolly the sheep, something called somatic cell nuclear transfer. And scientists in Oregon have just reported the first successful conversion of human skin cells into egg cells. And really remarkably, the starting cell doesn't have to come from a woman. So it opens up the possibility of creating eggs from the skin cells of men. So how did they do it? What they did was they removed the nucleus from collected skin cells and they transplanted that into a donor egg whose own nucleus had been removed. And this is where the scientists ran into one of their biggest hurdles, because a healthy human egg should only have 23 chromosomes, so that when it joins with the sperm, which also has 23, the fertilized egg ends up with the normal 46. But when you make an egg from a skin cell, it starts off with the full set of 46 chromosomes, which is too many for normal development.
Right.
So to fix this, the team used a clever trick, and after fertilizing the lab-made eggs with sperm, they added a chemical, and that triggered the egg to push out about half of its chromosomes into a tiny side structure called a polar body. And that left the remaining chromosomes ready to pair neatly, or so they thought, with those from the sperm, just like a natural egg. But again, in the Oregon experiment, the chromosomes actually often got mixed up. They paired randomly instead of neatly. So a lot of the embryos ended up with the wrong number of chromosomes, making them unlikely to grow into healthy babies.
It sounds quite complicated. Like, it sounds like it's not the easiest thing in the world to turn a skin cell into a fertilizable egg.
Absolutely. It's it's astonishing, actually, because, yeah, and 82% out of the 82 lab-made eggs, about 10%, fewer than 10% developed as far as embryos used in standard IVF. Now, none were grown for more than 6 days, so it is an impressive proof of concept, but it's far from ready for real-world use.
They weren't grown for more than 6 days for ethical reasons, correctly?
Correct. Yeah. Okay.
So
yeah.
We don't know whether or not they could or not, but I thought we'd already done this. I thought we had made stem cells from skin cells. This is the next step on, I suppose. This is going. So do they go through a transitionary phase? So people might remember, I always describe iPSC, pluripotent stem cells, as the ones that are reprogrammed. It's like wiping the letter off a Scrabble piece so they can be any letter. So like you can, once you have that, you've got a stem cell that can be almost anything. Do these egg cells go through that transitionary step from skin cell to blank Scrabble cell, then to the egg, or the different path?
No, not as far as I know. As far as I know, it's planted into the nucleus of the egg. And then that's when they started to try and separate the chromosomes at that stage. And if it is perfected, look, it could absolutely revolutionize fertility. It offers hope to women who've lost their eggs or for same-sex couples who want genetically related children. But as with everything, as it races forward, there's ethical and safety and practical hurdles emerging.
There was a movie in 2006. It had what's that kind of he's kind of handsome fella, Clive Owen, and in it, all the men have become infertile, and so basically, there's no babies left, and I think they probably hadn't thought of the possibility of reprogramming skin cells, but the idea that you could have a child that has two fathers and no mother.
It's undeniably astonishing to think that you could turn a skin cell into an egg. I think it's one of those moments where science is showing us how to do something long before we've worked out why we should or even if we should. So, yeah, look.
There's a few of those at the moment. Shane, my second story isn't really a medical advancement, but more a study of a gradual decline in cognitive ability in the United States. And while it is the United States that's being studied here, I think it is an important thing to both discuss and consider the implications and assume that this is not just a US-only phenomenon.
Yeah, this is a huge study in terms of people involved. It's looking at a data set that involved a whopping 4.5 million adults in the United States. And they were asked to self-report whether they had serious difficulty concentrating, remembering, or making decisions. So this is sort of a self-reported cognitive disability. That's how the authors are using that term. And they've seen in this study, just from surveying people, that the number of people who report having that disability has increased from 5.3% in 2013 up to 7.4% in 2023. Now, that is significant in terms of statistics, but when you drill into the figures a little bit more, you see that certain populations, certain groups are driving that increase. And the biggest one is younger adults. So people who are aged between 18 and 39. The prevalence of them saying they feel that they can't concentrate, have difficulty remembering, etc., that's nearly doubled in that time period. And then going further, because the data set's so big, they're able to see that certain groups, other factors like race, so for particularly Black and Hispanic adults, that's very, very high. And of course, the big one, as we always see in the United States with these issues too, socioeconomic class is another driver. So the increase for people who are in low income brackets has been almost 13%, 12.9%. So it's a whopping drive, a whopping increase in people in certain communities in the United States saying that they no longer feel they're able to concentrate and do basic things to the point that they feel they're less able.
So it would be unscientific for us to just throw out reasons. But I suppose we can talk about it nonetheless. One of the things that I would have thought immediately there was, access to screens, constant quicker decision making on social media, deciding what to watch. They're not having the time to make decisions. And this the th that doesn't necessarily I mean that like that idea as a theory of it being partially responsible doesn't necessarily map onto those, like a technology affects us all, and we all spend a lot of time on screens regardless. Diet, of course, we know has a big effect on cognitive ability, but it would be really interesting to try and unpack that and figure out what the
Yeah, you're
drivers
right.
are. Have they found any correlations?
Well, they show correlations between certain groups, right? So that socioeconomic driver and race drivers are huge issues because when you think we often think about what we're doing as individuals to drive these things, and perhaps we tend not to take into account the various geopolitical things that are going on in the world, the massive rise in income inequity. So people getting richer while other people are getting poorer. Rise in various other kind of, sort of threats to democracy as issues. Now, I'm offering views here that are postulated in the paper, but I do stress that they do not have any causal links in the paper. But I would say that I've read an awful lot about this from social scientists recently, and they're saying we should be cautious about assuming that it's technology that's always driving this.
Although technology probably will accelerate it, if you know, looking at the work that I do in helping businesses figure out AI, you know, if you are time poor, if like a lot of these groups, you struggle to make decisions, offloading a lot of those decisions to an AI seems like an attractive thing to do. And that's, you know, that's putting an enormous amount of power in the hands of companies that are now connecting commerce to your AI agent. You know, so you say, I'm thinking about doing this, and then they pop you up an ad, you can buy that product right in the thing, and the AI is telling you this is the sort of thing that you need. That, you know, that's, you know, it's entering a very interesting time for decision making.
It is. And there's a lot more to do here from the social science point of view, because you're right, people are time poor, but we have to ask, why are they time poor? What's driving that? Is it the availability of technology, or is it that people feel they're under pressure that they have to go to technology to do things? We don't have answers, but this data is very interesting.
Yeah. Shelley, our third story has to do with hyperscale computing. So we talk about AI a huge amount, and there's been this problem, right, that when you use computers and you use them a lot and use them to their max, they heat up. And that essentially is a problem if you want to continue meeting the needs of the world.
Yeah, exactly. So I suppose AI is now trying to solve the very problem it's created using so much energy that the hardware behind it now needs radical redesign. So like you said, Jonathan, every chatbot query, image generators, models that are learning to mimic our words or voices, they run on enormous racks of high-powered chips. And these chips burn through electricity and spit out heat. And the faster and the more powerful AI becomes, the more heat it produces. The hotter these chips get, the more energy is needed to keep them cool. And then also the more pressure is being put on the planet. So it's just unsustainable. And without new cooling methods, the world would soon hit what engineers call a thermal ceiling, where the chips simply can't be pushed any faster without cooking themselves, essentially. So we're watching a technology race to fix its own excesses in real time. So Microsoft have announced what it's calling a breakthrough called microfluidic cooling. And they're saying that it's made cooling up to 3 times more efficient. So instead of cooling from the outside, which is what's traditionally done, what engineers have done is they've etched microscopic channels inside the silicone, and it pumps liquid coolant directly through it rather than around it. So it's a little bit like giving the chip its own network of blood vessels. The coolant is flowing right past the hottest spots, and it draws the heat away more efficiently than traditional methods, because they only cooled from the surface, basically. And some of the shapes that they're using within the microscopic channels, they'd mimic the branching veins in leaves. So they're looking at nature's way of moving fluids more effectively.
Wow. And presumably this is still the research era, but it will be fast-tracked, I would imagine, because that sort of advance is of huge benefit to manufacturers when looking at how to meet the demands of the modern world. Really interesting.
Yeah.
Our final story, Shane, has to do with pain.
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, it's sort of necessary from a biological point of view. When you wallop your thumb with a hammer, you feel pain and it'll inflame. And that's part of the body's response for healing. And the inflammation allows various immune responses to arrive to the right site. The pain is helpful too, because it prevents you from continuing to use it as normal. So it forces you to rest and to kind of be aware of what's going on. Of course, all of us want to just get on with our lives when we feel any pain. In the United States, there's a whopping 30 billion doses per year of so-called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Now, listeners would know these as ibuprofen or aspirin. 30 billion doses a year, people popping these pills all of which are safe.
How does that work out versus the population of the country? About 280 million
people? Yeah, absolutely. If you go to the US, though, you often notice you can buy paracetamol, for example, in 500 units. So you can buy a jar of paracetamols that have 500 in them, which is crazy from a health and safety point of view. But yet you can do it. So what this study has shown, and I stress this is at a preclinical trial phase, they've shown that they've been able to decouple the necessary inflammation step from the pain step or the response. And they've been able to kind of turn off the pain switch while maintaining the natural inflammation response. Because at the moment, when you take an ibuprofen, it does everything. It stops the inflammation. It reduces the pain because it targets a particular receptor and it just does it in a blanket way. What this study is able to do is to kind of say, okay, we just want to turn off the pain, but we want to maintain the natural inflammation response. And this is absolutely incredible, right? Because that inflammation is very necessary as part of the healing. And it will increase your getting well quicker. So you wallop your thumb with the hammer and the inflammation will help that thumb get better. Incidentally, I shouldn't be let you DIY.
I've been doing it myself the last weekend. Actually, for the first time in my life, I took on a project and it all went very well. It wasn't a small project. It was a big project. And I made a piano desk with a folding hinge. And everything just fit into it perfectly, built in. And then I went to put a toilet latch on the bathroom door and I've absolutely balls up the whole door. Like just the really tricky, you know, jigsaw type of job. That went really well. The stupid, simple 10-second job I've absolutely messed up. A nice old door has been there for 50 years and now it's screwed. So absolutely classic McRae. Before we go, Shane, have to say, very proud of you. Like not just one now, but two books. And this second book is just launched this week. Tell us about it.
It's called The Experimenters and it's written about my niece and nephew. And it's another children's science book. Crucially, for parents listening, it doesn't involve having to buy expensive kit or have to use computers or anything like that. It's all just stuff you find around the house, noticing things in your garden, baking things in your kitchen, washing up in the bathroom and so on, and adding a certain kind of science magic into those day-to-day things.
And it's like having all of the smarts of Shane without actually having him in the room, which is fantastic.
Well, actually, I'm in the book too. So,
I know. Yeah, but we don't have to see you. We don't have to hear you, which is great.
I know. It's like your ideal news round. Exactly.
Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD and Dr. Shelley Brady from the Insight Center for Data Analytics at DCU. Thank you so much for joining us. For many people in Ireland, a diagnosis can be a source of immense relief, a validation of sorts. It can also open up access to crucial support. But for others, could that same diagnosis lead to unnecessary worry or a reliance on medication or worse? Our next guest argues that we're becoming all too willing to label difference as medical disorder and that we are turning healthy people into patients. Dr. Susanna Sullivan is an award-winning neurologist and author whose book is called The Age of Diagnosis. Suzanne, very welcome to the program. I suppose the first thing that we should do is just say that, you know, we're not, that this interview, it's not about questioning people's diagnoses necessarily or downplaying people's diagnosis of things like autism or ADHD. That's not what you're trying to do.
No, I'm very much not saying that. And, you know, I like people to realize that if they have a diagnosis that they found really useful to them, then they shouldn't feel challenged at all by this conversation. But what I want people to understand is that medical diagnoses have downsides as well as upsides. So that when somebody is entering into the journey to get a diagnosis, they understand how those things are balanced. And it's really important that the harms of diagnosis are balanced correctly against the benefits. The benefits are things like, you know, getting a support group, getting a treatment pathway, understanding what's happening to you. But the harms come with the label of being diagnosed. When a person is diagnosed, they can inadvertently conform to the label that is given to them. That can actually make the symptoms worse instead of better. other people can treat them differently. They can view themselves differently. A diagnosis can be a self-fulfilling prophecy. So people really need to understand those downsides if they're going to enter into that diagnostic journey.
I'm interested to hear your thoughts, because you're not a psychotherapist, a psychiatrist or a psychologist. You're a neurologist and a clinician in neurophysiology. When you talk about ADHD or autism from your point of view, how are you defining those things? Because spectrum is a word that's used quite a lot to describe some of these conditions. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how we diagnose these particular conditions.
So I think that's a really important thing for people to understand, which is that these conditions are not defined by any abnormal pathology. There's no test, there's no brain scan, there's no genetic test that can tell a person that they have autism or ADHD. These disorders are defined entirely according to a set of typical symptoms. So that is quite a subjective process. There are quite rigid assessments that are supposed to make these diagnoses reasonably reliable. But even within those rigid assessments, how an individual practitioner applies the diagnosis can be quite different. And we're talking about difficulties that are really quite ubiquitous to us. So for ADHD, it maybe often loses things, often fidgety, difficulty concentrating. Or for autism, it may refer to difficulties with social communication. Since we all have these difficulties at some point in our lives, it can be very easy to overdiagnose these conditions. The other thing that's really important for people to understand is that these are disorders that have been diagnosed purely on collections of symptoms since they were first devised in the 1940s to the 1960s. And we have been gradually adjusting what types of symptoms and what amount of symptoms are needed to make the diagnosis. And that adjustment has happened over many decades. And it's happened in order to allow more and more people into the diagnostic groups in order to help more and more people. What's important to understand in that is that that's not so much a scientific process. That's a committee decision by doctors and scientists who live in society. So in many senses, it's a societal decision has been made to adjust diagnostic criteria, not according to science, but according to our belief we can help more people if we can find more people.
Are you talking about the definition of these conditions in the DSM, essentially diagnostic manual, where someone working in this area might say, this is now what we call autism, this is now what we call, and there's a number of boxes that you tick. And if you tick those, you then are diagnosed with ADHD or autism. Is that what you mean? Because my understanding is that those definitions have changed, as you say, to broaden out. And so someone who didn't have autism before, in the 1980s may have autism now, and vice versa with other conditions. I mean, how difficult is it to fully understand and diagnose a condition when the sands are shifting like that?
Yeah, so that's precisely what I am saying. In the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, every time there's a new edition of this encyclopedia of mental health and neurodevelopmental disorders, the diagnostic criteria change because a committee of doctors decide that the existing criteria are not quite good enough. And the impact of that, for example, on autism would be that 50 years ago, to have autism, you had to have quite a severe level of social communication difficulty and behavioral difficulty, and it had to be evident before the age of 30 months. And then another committee comes together and says, well, maybe we're missing some children that way. Let's say that the difficulties don't need to be quite so severe, and perhaps they're not evident until a little later in life. And those adjustments have been happening in little tiny bits over many decades, so that autism has changed from a condition that was caused very severe disability in very young children to a disorder that causes much more minimal difficulties in much older people and can now be diagnosed in adulthood. So it's just a collection of symptoms as described in the DSM, and they're then applied in structured interviews and assessments done by psychologists who will hopefully make the diagnosis in a reliable way. But even that is being called into question now, because if I give an example of a study that was done in the US in about 2022, I think, where researchers recruited people for a study that they were doing into autism. These were people in the community who had already been given a diagnosis. And when they applied the structured interviews and the diagnostic criteria of the DSM to this group of people with existing diagnosis of autism, they judged that only about 47% of these people actually met the diagnostic criteria according to their standards.
Wow.
So we have the double problem of the diagnostic criteria changing all the time, but also potentially being applied less rigidly in some communities.
Which is, I suppose, completely understandable, because we are talking about human beings as opposed to machines. And so it's not so binary when we're talking about people's experiences and their feelings and how they might express, or how they may even talk about their own selves, the intensity by which they talk about themselves. They may use the same words, but that intensity may be judged as a higher number on a grading scale. And I suppose for me, one of the questions that arises is, at what point do these things become a disorder? Because we talk about autism, but actually, you know, the full name for the condition is autism spectrum disorder. ADHD is a disorder. And for me, I've sat at dinner tables where people have many, many times, Suzanne, casually diagnosed me with ADHD. And for me, I think, you know, the focus really should be on disorder. What does disorder mean from a medical point of view? Because I think that I certainly have I'm highly strung. I don't know, you know, what are the how should I respond to people who diagnose me with ADHD over Vullabons?
Yeah, it's such an important point, because I think, you know, in public conversation, very often these disorders are distilled down to traits that we all have. You know, becoming intensely interested in something, or losing your concentration, or not being able to look people in the eye. But for any of these difficulties to qualify as autism or ADHD, they must involve impairment. And that's the kind of diagnostic step that I think is often neglected. So it's not good enough to be someone who's highly strung, or someone who has poor attention. Those problems should be a problem that cause impairment. Now, this is a very difficult point, however, because no one really has rigidly defined what impairment is. So when I was researching this subject, I spoke to one psychologist who does assessments, and she described a scenario in which a person who was in their 40s, so an adult who had not been previously diagnosed, disclosed that they went to the supermarket and they found the lights and the noise of the supermarket very tiring. So when they went home, they went to bed, and their difficulty was such that nobody in their family had ever noticed it. But to this psychologist, the fact that this person had to have a nap after going to the supermarket, she counted that as impairment. Mm. Now, I would not count that as impairment. I would say that impairment means you cannot go to the supermarket. I would say that impairment means you cannot do the ordinary thing you should be able to do. And I think this is where the medical community needs to tighten up the definition. But it's also something that when people are casually diagnosing their friends, they need to understand it's not the trait, it's the degree to which the trait stops you doing ordinary things that matters.
Yeah. And at the same time, I have spoken to, I'm familiar with colleagues, friends of friends who have, as you say, received an enormous amount of validation and relief that, oh, there's something different about me, and now I understand why I am the way I am. And these, you know, these are successful people who function in society, although sometimes, like me, they can be perhaps a little, you know, perhaps not the best social communicators. And so if a diagnosis helps somebody, does it do harm?
Well, I think, again, I wouldn't wish to take away a diagnosis from someone who has found it genuinely helpful in moving them forward in their lives in some way that mattered to them. However, I do think it's important that we look at the kind of bigger picture of this. I think it's particularly difficult in teenagers. So it's quite common now for teenagers to be diagnosed as ADHD or autism when they're in that adolescent stage and they're having difficulties in life. Now, that can be really validating if you're struggling. But what else does it do apart from validate? it potentially reinforces the difficulties. If your difficulty in adolescence is presented to you as a neurodevelopmental brain disorder, well, that sounds very permanent, and that sounds like something one cannot necessarily overcome. That can give permanency to the symptoms. The difficulties may get worse by focusing your attention on them. Other people might treat you differently because now you are a person with ADHD or autism who is perceived not to be able to do things. Adolescence is a time of great change, and this sort of concept of a neurodevelopmental brain disorder that really sounds very concrete, but for which there is no scientific evidence that it is a concrete and permanent problem, can stop people progressing through life. I also think we need to look at the bigger picture for the disorder itself. So concepts like autism were created to help a very distinct group of people, and these are people with very, very severe disabilities, complete inability to communicate, often with learning disabilities, but not necessarily. When we broaden that criteria to the very ordinarily functioning person with the normal IQ who has no outward evidence of autism to the casual observer, how does that affect those people in the severe group? It means that the group has been broadened so much that it's actually quite hard to research it in a meaningful way, and it potentially directs the resources away from the severely affected person. So I think validation is great, but let's think of the bigger picture. How does it affect the development of an adolescent to be thought of in this way, and how does it affect the group as a whole?
Yeah, and so what happens as a result of that, because autism, for example, is diagnosed as a spectrum, and you have people who have very light autism who you would interact with and would not know, but they have their own struggles that may not be as apparent as someone who has severely limiting autism. And so these sort of caveats and brackets are put in front of the word autism to separate these. But I suppose, if you have someone who has such severe autism that they cannot function day to day, they can't take part in regular schooling, they need constant assistance and care, should we not rename those conditions to ensure, like, narrow down or at least split up the definition of autism to ensure that we're talking or comparing like with like? And I want to be very, very conscious of how I'm talking about this condition. So I don't know if I need to be corrected there, Suzanne, please do step in. But it's a question that comes from ignorance and interest rather than presumption.
Yeah, no, I think what you're suggesting is what will happen. Because at the moment, you know, scientific study into this condition is being affected by the fact that the group is so varied now that you're comparing, you know, high functioning bankers, actors with people who have learning disabilities and can't possibly go to school even and need, you know, a huge amount of supervision. So the only way for us to really understand autism, both what causes it and how best to help people with severe autism, is to divide this group up. There's something very strange about that, because there already was a concept called autism that was supposed to identify these severely affected people and help them. And now what we're kind of suggesting is that autism now will be given to a different group, and that we now give a different name to this other group. If that's what it takes to solve it, then I'm okay with it. But it's a very strange thing that's happening.
I don't know, did you speak to anyone about the funding of programs to help people who are struggling with their lives and do have impairments day to day because of autism? If everybody who has any place on the autism spectrum is labeled as having autism and is then accessing supports on a national level, is that a problem, or is that just people who need help need to access help and that's that?
Yeah, I think that another important point is that I'm not suggesting that we go back. So I was in school in the 70s and 80s, and to the best of my knowledge, in a class of 120, nobody was recognized as having any special needs. Mm. And that cannot possibly have been correct. There must have been people who would have flourished more if they had been noticed to have slightly different learning needs. I'm not suggesting for a moment we go back to that. I think we still need to be able to recognize adolescents in particular who are struggling in school. It's such a vital time of life. And if you fail in education then because someone didn't notice you had a slightly different need, it can impact your whole life. So I think we still need to be able to recognize people are suffering, and we still need to be able to help people who are suffering. But I think we need to ask ourselves, can we not do that without these medical labels? Yeah. Sometimes medical labels are absolutely necessary, but other times we should be able to say, well, you know what, that person learns differently. Let's try and teach them differently without actually giving them medical labels. I think it's also important for us to recognize that what we're doing now isn't working. So it maybe that it's not working for some other reason than what I'm saying. I'm concerned about overdiagnosis, but it could be just we're helping people in the wrong way. We've had escalating autism and ADHD diagnosis in adolescents since the 90s. And we should really expect that we begin to see happier, better adjusted young adults as a result of those escalating diagnoses. We're not seeing that. We're seeing more anxious, more distressed young adults. So either we're getting the diagnosis wrong or we're getting the treatment wrong. I think we really need to stand back and do something differently.
That that point that you mentioned about people struggling and needing that support, not necessarily labeling it as a medical condition, I think is really crucial, because I'm always brought back to this comment from the former governor of Mountjoy, John Lonergan, who he said, I think it was like 50-80% of prisons are filled with people who had reading disabilities in school. And that to me is just such a crushing statistic when we think about how we fail children who don't follow the typical cookie cutter approach of what we would like to imagine as an ideal student. It's a really interesting and complex issue. I don't think we resolved it today, but I think it is something that we need to talk about. Dr. Susanna Sullivan, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, time to look back at some of your comments from last week's episode. And we had the brilliant Mary Roach on the program talking about regenerative medicine with her new book. Really, really interesting. We were talking about xenotransplantation, moving body parts from animals to humans once they've gone through a process of sort of making them safe from an immunological point of view. And someone says, I wonder how do immunological rejections differ between allografts and xenografts? So this is from human to human versus animal to human. My understanding is that the process is the same. It's a foreign body that's not recognized by the immune system. And so the immune response, I would imagine, would be to attack either if they're not familial DNA. But I actually don't know if you get a stronger response. So that's a good question. Someone else says, Jonathan, if full replacement becomes possible, what standards would we need to be defined for equivalence, for example, strength and longevity? Look, I mean, if we could fully replace just any part of the body, then a whole new world opens up in many ways, right? We'll have people who are less who they were after several replacements than who they were before. Are they the donated person, or are they themselves? Like, at what point do we stop becoming ourselves if we replace all the blood, replace all the body parts, and the only thing that's keeping us together and sane is our actual brains? The sense of self becomes a real big question. It's a very valid question. And then, you know, if we can make any part, then I suppose what you're getting will need to be of a certain standard. And you might find that, you know, in a science fiction world, you might find that some people are replacing their, you know, in a science fiction world, you might find that some people are replacing their subpar hearts or lungs with brand new transplanted ones. So, you know, we could go all the way down this theoretical rabbit hole if we wanted to. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thanks to Marisa Sullivan, Rory Galvin, Hugo da Silva, Scott Unsigned. Thank you for listening. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.